You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jen Zaman, and I am in for Judy Ansel this evening. Tonight's show is being underwritten by AFT Kansas and Blake and Ulick. AFT Kansas is teachers, nurses, and healthcare professionals and workers in our universities, cities, counties, and state. Our mission is to be good partners in building thriving communities by reclaiming the promise of strong public schools, of quality public services, and of healthcare institutions that put patients before profits. Blake and Ulick, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, the UAW now has 30,000 members who work at universities, and they don't think like auto workers. This week, we will ask if the UAW is headed for an identity crisis. And then Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein came to town this week and talked to us about her vision for jobs and a more equal economy. She opposes voting for the lesser of two evils. Tune in to the first in a series on presidential candidate positions on labor. In the news, Missouri Moneybags political donors inject big bucks into the state's primaries. And more on your right to talk to fellow workers about your wages. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. And now, the news.
This is the news from our side, July 7, 2016. Many may have seen the Kansas City Star article last week about 17-year-old Jensen Wilcott of Bonner Springs, who got a summer job at Pisa Studio at the Legends and got fired the same day after she compared salaries with a male friend and found she was paid 25 cents less per hour for the same job with the same experience. Jensen called her new boss to ask why and got fired on the spot for discussing wages, which she was told was against company policy. We don't know how Hillary Clinton found out and tweeted about it, but the boss got fired and Jensen got an apology, but not an explanation. Pisa Studio denied that gender was a factor in Jensen's lower wage. Many bosses break the law when they tell workers not to discuss wages. If you're an employee and not a hire and fire type supervisor, you have the right to talk about wages with one another and anything else from those people brown-nosing and getting a better shift, to how the owner steals your tips, to slippery floors that are a fall hazard. It's your right under the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which also gives you the right to organize and form a union. Yet gag rules are rampant. A 2014 study by the Institute for Women's Policy Research found about half of all workers report that discussion of wage and salary information is either discouraged or prohibited and or could lead to punishment. In public employment, most compensation is already public, but among private sector workers, 62% of women and 60% of men report that wage and salary information is a secret.
Worried about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? You should be. Even under NAFTA, foreign corporations can sue the U.S., the state of Missouri, or even Kansas City for abiding by our own laws to protect the environment or food safety or labor relations. or labor regulations. The right of foreign corporations to challenge laws passed by governments comes under the so-called Investor-State Dispute Resolution Procedure, or ISDS. Now, TransCanada, the company behind the Keystone XL pipeline, is seeking $15 billion in damages from the U.S. federal government because the Obama administration rejected the pipeline. They say the State Department led them to believe the permit would be approved. So why $15 billion when the pipeline only cost $8 billion to build and it isn't even built yet? That's because of a provision in NAFTA and other trade agreements like the TPP, which calculate losses to a foreign investor from what's called regulatory takings to include future profits. That means if a regulation deprives a foreign company of its business, then it must be compensated not only for the value of its investment, but also for all future profits for years to come. No domestic corporation gets such a deal. Furthermore, this case won't be decided in our courts under our laws. It'll be decided by an international arbitration panel whose judges won't have to follow our laws and who are generally corporate trade lawyers. Right now, 10% of foreign investment in the U.S. comes from nations with whom we have these kinds of free trade agreements. Mostly, it's Canadian investment. That would change radically if the TPP is passed. According to trade lawyer and expert Sanya Reed-Smith of the Third World Network, the percent of foreign investment from countries which can use ISDS will jump to 70%. There could be a barrage of cases challenging everything from new laws limiting pollution from hog farms to raising the minimum wage. So parents, tell your kids they have rights, and maybe they'll get a tweet from Hillary, too, if they stand up to the boss.
Last week, we reported about the boycott against David Humphrey's Tamco building products because of his sponsorship of anti-union ads on radio and TV. Now the Kansas City Star reports on Humphrey's donations to candidates challenging Republicans who sided with labor on right-to-work legislation. It said he and his family have poured $2.7 million into a political action committee that for months has been targeting Republicans who oppose a right-to-work law. His money has found its way into the campaign coffers of a handful of Republicans who are challenging incumbent state lawmakers in GOP primaries, setting up intra-party battles across the state. Meanwhile, St. Louis mega-rich right-winger Rex Singfield and family just donated $1.4 million to the primary campaign of Republican State Senator Kurt Schaefer of Columbia, running for Missouri Secretary of State. Schaefer earned a lot of notoriety for his interference this year in academic freedom and due process rights at MU. But Singfield and Humphreys can't agree on which Republican for that office to back. Humphreys and his sister just gave $750,000 to Josh Hawley, a University of Missouri Columbia law professor running against Schaefer in the primary. The news this evening was read by Molly Madden, Jen Zaman, and I'm Greg Swartz.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Dr. Jill Stein is running for president. She did so once before in 2012. Her platform on the Green Party reads like a wish list for any left-leaning activist. She's a doctor and has been involved for years in fighting for environmental health. She co-founded Massachusetts Coalition for Healthy Communities, ran for governor against Mitt Romney, and for other state offices, never winning but coming close. She also helped pass a clean election law in Massachusetts through a referendum, but it was repealed by the Democrat-controlled legislature. We're recording this interview on July 2nd here in Kansas City, where Jill is campaigning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, too.
Well, it's great to have you here, and we really appreciate your coming in. I want to focus on labor issues.
Great.
And later talk about that awful S-word spoiler.
Great.
But first, tell us in general what you stand for. You talk about a human-centered economy that puts people, planet, and peace over profit. A lot of P's there. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a world right now and an economy which is really dominated by the principle of profit. And it's sort of a profiteering economy, a profiteering healthcare system, a profiteering education system. And it's really throwing people under the bus. Most people, you know, the 99% is really very much the victim of this predatory economy. It's brought us to a place where, you know, where average wages are barely above poverty, where the jobs that came back, so-called, are low-wage, part-time, temporary jobs. We have an entire generation of young people and now not-so-young people who are locked into predatory student loan debt, black lives on the firing line, immigrants threatened with mass deportation. What's wrong with this picture? Banks are doing great. Billionaires are doing great. You know, 22 of them have the wealth in the United States equivalent to half of the American population. So, yes, we need a different kind of economy, and it's not going to be fixed around the margins. In this race, I'm the one candidate that's not poisoned by corporate money, by money from lobbyists, from the usual suspects who are pulling the strings behind closed doors of our political system. That is the predatory banks, the fossil fuel giants, war profiteers, insurance companies. That's who runs the show, and ordinary working people have really been thrown to the wolves. So what's really exciting, I think, in this race is that people are standing up, we are getting together, and not just on one issue. We're building a broad coalition for people, planet, and peace over profit, and discovering, oh my God, we are not like the radical fringe. We really are the heart and soul of the American conscience, of American communities, and we have the power, we have the numbers, we have the solutions to turn this around.
So it sounds like you want to get rid of capitalism? Is that where you're at?
So, you know, truth to tell, I don't use a lot of isms because they mean different things to different people, and we can get dug in around the definitions of things. But if you're saying, do I reject a predatory economy, an economy that puts profit over people? Yes, absolutely. And if socialism means an economy that works for everyday working people, that believes in the golden rule, that believes we should have economic democracy, where we the people are in control, I say yes, bring it on.
Okay. Well, that's good. You've also said that our political system's broken. And I think lots of people get that. But I wanted to ask you to talk about the Democratic Party, since you're probably going to be pulling votes from them or from their traditional supporters. Where did they go wrong? What's wrong with the Democrats?
Great. And so first, I just want to make the point that I think a lot of people really understand, and that is that politicians are not entitled to our votes. Our votes are not a new form of entitlement for politicians or predatory political parties. They are not entitled to this. They have to earn this. Many people are waking up to the fact that this entitlement, whereby we just pledge allegiance to a political party and vote for it no matter what, you know, that that's gotten us in deep trouble. And, you know, to look specifically at the Democrats and what we've accomplished, it's really critical, I think, to do exactly that. Let's look at the record, because we're always told, you know, we have to vote against the greater evil and, you know, vote against our fears rather than for what we believe. This is that whole lesser evilism. So the reality is, when you look back, where have we gotten with this? That politics of fear actually delivered everything we were afraid of. All the reasons we were told to vote for the lesser evil, with a Democrat in the White House and with two Democratic houses of Congress for those first 2 years until people just flipped out and started voting against it and voting their anger and their disappointment at the Democratic Party and the promises that came along with Obama's election. If you actually look at the record under the Democrats, what did they do? Export our jobs. And in fact, that began under Bill Clinton, who signed NAFTA.
And actually began under Jimmy Carter.
In fact, yes. So it's been Republicans in between. But the point here is that, you know, putting our faith in Democrats has not fixed this. And, you know, Obama now is pushing for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, you know, this is NAFTA on steroids. So You know, we were voting against our fears of losing our jobs. We lost our jobs more so. On the climate, you know, we were told you didn't want the climate meltdown, so you had to vote for the Democrat. But in fact, Obama's policy of all of the above actually turned out to be far more destructive to the climate than what George Bush was able to accomplish.
How is that?
Because all of the above kind of reassured people into thinking that this is okay, you don't need to watchdog it. And it was delivered by the gracious, you know, very likable personality of Barack Obama. So people were also told, don't resist the Democrats because you're going to empower the Republicans. So people progressives tend to go along with what the Democrats are doing, and they don't really throw down a challenge the way they did to Bush and to Republicans.
So you're saying the Democrats have demobilized people?
That tends to happen, yes, to the peace movement as well, but specifically on climate. What happened, and it's important to be really clear about this, yes, we increased renewable energy, and that was part of Obama's all of the above. We doubled our renewable energy. That's not nothing, but unfortunately, renewable energy was such a tiny portion of the energy mix to start with. It only went from like 3 to 6%, something like that, while they basically took the lid off of fossil fuel production and skyrocketed the extraction of fossil fuels offshore, on public lands, fracking, from coast to coast, fracking around the world, thanks to Hillary Clinton and her, you know, office for fracking in the Secretary of State's department, opening up the Arctic to exploration. These massive things have happened to greatly escalate fossil fuel extraction. And so they say, well, but our emissions have gone down because they're exporting it. And in fact, while the Obama administration was negotiating the Paris Agreement, about which they were, you know, cheering, and it has some good things in it, mostly symbolic, but at the same time, this is a voluntary agreement. What were they doing behind closed doors? They were giving a thumbs up to basically whole new policy of exporting fossil fuels. We've had an export ban on fossil fuels and oil in particular, and actually fracked oil. We've had a fossil fuel ban on exports for decades, and that has helped keep the lid on extraction. They got rid of that ban, which basically takes the roof off of fossil fuel production here in the U.S. And this is far more harmful to the climate than the couple percent increase in renewables. Yeah. So, or to look at the expanding wars, you know, it was George Bush actually who put a date of withdrawal that Obama finally had to surrender to. This was when the immunity of U.S. soldiers ended. That's ultimately why Obama had to pull the troops out of Iraq. But he was fighting that tooth and nail in order to extend that war. And then in the meanwhile, you know, he surged into Afghanistan. We've promoted the drone wars all over the place. We went into Libya and had that disaster. He went along with it. It was Hillary Clinton leading the charge. So, you know, we make the point that this politics of fear delivered everything we were afraid of. The attack on immigrants, massive deportations, more than all other presidents of the 20th century combined. The attack on the press and on our civil liberties and the right of the press to investigate and tell the truth and to be a whistleblower, you know, using the Espionage Act to hound and persecute the press. So the politics of fear brought us everything we were afraid of. At the end of the day, the lesser evil is not a solution, because ultimately people won't come out to vote. The base won't come out to vote for politicians that are throwing them under the bus. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans have won race after race, mainly because the Democratic base won't come out to support governors and congressmen and women and so on. So by default, the Republicans are winning. The lesser evil is not going to save us. We're going to save ourselves by standing up against these corporate political parties and leading the way forward. We say, forget the lesser evil, fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because they do.
This is Judy Ansel. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and I'm talking to Dr. Jill Stein, the Green candidate for president. So let's talk about jobs. You talk about good jobs, green jobs, jobs as a right, that everybody should have a right to a job. I'm sure most of my friends in the labor movement would get behind that. But how do we get there? You know, let's say you win the presidency. Mm-hmm. What would you do in order to create those kinds of jobs, let alone stop the corporate backlash against
them? Great. So what's really important in all of this, and what I want to stress at the beginning, is that this is not just hypothetical. Right now, first, how do we get into the presidency? There are 43 million young people who are trapped in predatory student loan debt, who do not have a future. They don't have a home. They don't have a job. They can't pay back the debt. They can't have a family. The birth rate is plummeting here in the U.S. This has everything to do with a generation that has basically been hung out to dry. Mm-hmm. And they are missing in action because they're too busy working 2 and 3 part-time jobs, trying to keep a roof over their heads and pay back their debt. So the number one thing that we do in order to enable all these other things, we bring them in. How do we bring them in? We liberate them from their debt. And by promising to liberate them from debt, which is something the president can do without Congress, and I'll tell you how in just 1 minute, by liberating young people from their debt, we give them a real incentive to come out. 43 million is a winning plurality of the vote. We actually have the numbers. This is not pie in the sky. We're not talking about splitting the vote. We're talking about flipping the vote. So we've gone from 2% to 7%. That is, we tripled our numbers in 1 month alone without any help from corporate media, which hasn't covered us basically to date at all. Now we're beginning to get a trickle. But we went from 2% to 7% with no coverage, mainly because young people are self-mobilizing with this idea, oh my God, we can come out to vote and cancel our debt. So how, say 43 million people turn out to cancel debt and they're voting green, thereby they are bringing forward a whole progressive agenda that includes not only canceling debt, it's the right to public higher education, and it is the right to a good job, an emergency jobs program as part of an emergency solution to the climate crisis. So we're liberating two birds with one movement here. And how does the president do that? Because that's kind of like the first critical question. Well, the same way that we bailed out the bankers, the crooks on Wall Street who crashed the economy, somehow our fearless leaders saw fit to do them the favor and forgive their trillions of dollars worth of debt. And they wiped it out with a so-called quantitative easing, which is a simple thing for the Fed to do. So the president turns out to have the power of appointment over the Federal Reserve. So the president appoints the head of the Fed who understands this. The Fed then basically cancels student debt. It's over and done with in a way that has essentially been a stimulus package for the economy. What better way to improve the economy than liberating young people to actually do what they're trained to do, to start small businesses, worker cooperatives, etc., doing the really critical things they need to do for the new economy.
Okay, so pursuing this jobs angle, workers in this country have great difficulty in organizing. Mm-hmm. We are underpaid, mm-hmm. overworked, at least some of them, and then we have a problem of underemployment as well. The private sector employs most people. The private sector is focused on its profits. And so how would you convert lousy jobs into good jobs?
So this is where the Green New Deal comes in. And this is not a new invention. We actually did this as part of the New Deal that helped get us out of the Great Depression. So there's a whole model for many ways that we create jobs. And the New Deal was predominantly government jobs. And our Green New Deal calls for a mix. Government jobs, small businesses, and that is not large multinational corporations, which take the profit out of the community to corporate headquarters somewhere else. We're talking about local, people-controlled economies. So the support, the financial support, and I'll talk about that in a minute, it goes to communities to decide what they need to do in order to become sustainable. Sustainable ecologically, but also sustainable socially, economically, racially. So there are certain guidelines to how this money, which is nationally funded, how that money will be spent creating 20 million jobs. And these jobs can be through a mix of small businesses, worker cooperatives, and community cooperatives. And we will have special supports, in fact, establish a cabinet level department of the cooperative economy in order to support workers who want to establish a worker cooperative and a worker-controlled factory for solar panels, for example.
What about improving the jobs we have, the low-wage jobs?
Great. So there you have, first of all, we also call for a national minimum wage of $15 an hour. Uh-huh. So that will be one way to improve those jobs. Another is that by providing, again, quality at least 15 an hour jobs, you put real pressure on the rest of the private sector to match that. We also call for a food renaissance and for a local food system, which is very important for meeting the climate change, but it's also really important for improving our health, because right now we put our subsidies into this nutrient-poor corporate food system, which is making us sick, doesn't make
and
us healthy.
Making people all over the world sick because we're dumping those products everywhere.
Which
makes me want to ask you about trade.
Great.
Last week, Donald Trump called for the repeal of NAFTA and no passage of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. He said he wants to renegotiate trade agreements to get a better deal. How does your position differ from his?
Well, we call for renegotiating these treaties so that we have a fair trade agreement, not a rigged trade agreement.
He makes it seem as if, you know, like Mexico and Canada got the better deal on NAFTA, hardly. Which is not true.
Not true, because we put millions of people out of work. In fact, one of our answers to Donald Trump is that we don't need no friggin' wall. We just have to stop invading other countries, both militarily and also economically, because NAFTA, you know, is driving and has been driving the immigration crisis in many ways, because we've not only put farmers out of work, we put factory workers out of work,
Absolutely.
Too. Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is all about benefiting the billionaire class around the world. Doesn't really matter where you live. It's the billionaires that are doing great.
And so they're the beneficiaries, not the Mexicans.
Hardly. You know, American workers and workers all over the world, this is a race to the bottom, and that's what these trade agreements are doing. So we call for renegotiating these trade agreements and stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership as a first order of business now.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I want to be sure to ask you about, as I said, the S word. You know, in 2000, I voted for Ralph Nader. I live in Kansas, and I figured it doesn't really matter who I vote for because, you know, we know the Republicans are going to win anyway. Mm-hmm. But it is a real question, since you appear to be appealing to the Bernie voters to come to you rather than holding their nose and voting for Hillary. So, what happens if Trump wins because the progressive vote is split?
So let me remind you, many of the things Trump says, which are so scary, Hillary Clinton's already done. So,
like what?
Well, like basically a war on immigrants. Okay, so Hillary Clinton created a whole mass of immigrants by approving the coup, the corporate coup in Honduras. So she created the immigrants, and then she slammed the door on those immigrants. It's the Democrats who are conducting night raids right now, not on Muslims, but on Latinos. So that's okay. You know, it's okay
for Democrats. So you're saying Hillary's just as bad as Trump?
I don't know about just as bad. Well, Trump doesn't have a record yet. He's all talk. He's all bluster. Yeah. Who knows what he will do? But I know that Hillary Clinton has a horrific track record on immigrants, on deporting them, on saying, no, those women and children are much too dangerous. Don't let them come here fleeing the violence that she, Hillary, helped create in Honduras. This is absolutely outrageous. Trump is talking a hypothetical. Hillary's actually doing it. Is it okay to slam, you know, Latino immigrants from Honduras, mothers and children who are fleeing for their lives, people who are running from the drug wars in Mexico? This is absolutely outrageous. On climate, Hillary has been a major promoter of fracking around the world. Trump may not believe in this country, he may not believe in climate change. It turns out in Scotland, he does believe in climate change because he's trying to build a wall to protect his golf course because of sea level rise caused by climate. So Trump doesn't have a record. He talks very scary, but Hillary Clinton has done very scary. That war in Libya was probably the most catastrophic, outrageous war in modern history. Absolutely unjustified, with horrific consequences. Where does ISIS coming from? You know, from the likes of Libya and all the weapons that got released and proliferated around the Middle East, thanks to that. And on nuclear weapons, I don't want his finger on the button, but I don't want Hillary's finger on the button either, because what does Hillary want in Syria? She wants an air war with Russia, a nuclear armed power. This could turn into a slippery slope to disaster in the blink of an eye. So I am terrified if Trump gets elected. And I'm terrified if Hillary gets elected. And I am most horrified by a political system that gives us two deadly choices. And it says, here, pick your weapon of self-destruction. We got to say no to that system. We have to reject this propaganda of the lesser evil and fight for the greater good. Democracy needs a moral compass. Democracy is not what we don't want. Democracy is not who we are most afraid of. We've seen where that gets us. Just more of the same. People will not come out and vote for a political predator that's throwing them under the bus, even if they are not the worst predator in the world. So it's going to default to the Republicans no matter what. We've got to stand up. We have to face the music. It's not going to be easy. We're going to have to stand up and fight for it. And if we lose an election or two along the way, that's okay, because our goal here is to build our power for the long haul. And I think people are waking up to that reality. They are not being intimidated by this politics of fear that has delivered exactly what we were afraid of. We need to lead the way forward. In the words of Alice Walker, biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jill Stein.
Great talking with you, Judy.
Pair Excellence 3, locally yours. A beer pairing with Anton's Tap Room and Cinderblock Brewing Company at Anton's Tap Room on July 21st at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. This five-course dinner will feature pairings from the chef at Anton's and the head brewer of Cinderblock, specifically paired to bring out the best aspects of each course. Locally brewed and locally grown, July 21st, this beer pairing dinner is at Anton's Tap Room at 1610 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Reserve your seat today at kkfi.org/events. All proceeds benefit 90.1 FM KKFI.
August 2nd is primary election day in both Missouri and Kansas. Register to vote in Missouri by July 6th or in Kansas by July 12th. Voters like you will decide the many contested primary elections. Attend the Johnson County League of Women Voters Forum to get to know your Kansas candidates. More information is available at lwvjoco.org. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black.
Hi, this is Jacob White, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Returning to the show this week is Dr. Barry Eidlin, Assistant Professor of Sociology at McGill University in Montreal. Last time we had Dr. Eidlin on the show, we discussed differences in labor management relations between the United States and Canada. Dr. Eidlin also has a new academic article published in June in the American Sociological Review about why the U.S. does not have a labor party like every other country in the advanced industrial world, and no doubt that's an important topic as we are heading towards what Chris Hayes recently called a future in which politics is primarily a battle between cosmopolitan financial capitalism and ethno-nationalist backlash. So we hope to find time to discuss that article sometime before this fall's elections. But today we have Dr. Eidlin on the show to talk about his piece from June, which was published first in Jacobin, titled The House That Reuther Built. So Dr. Eidlin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Jacob. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks. Can you go a bit into detail about the Treaty of Detroit, which you argue is a really central piece of U.S. labor history, especially the auto industry history? And I know that there's been a lot written about the topic, but if you sort of wanted to extrapolate into how and when and why the auto industry and the workers in the auto industry were able to set the tone for the standard of living for a broad section of the U.S. working class.
Yeah. So in the article, I talk about the Treaty of Detroit, which is the name that is attributed to the 1950 contract that was signed between the United Auto Workers and General Motors, which was considered a landmark contract at the time. As there's a real paradox in the Treaty of Detroit, in that it was at the same time sort of a crowning achievement for labor, as well as planting the seeds of its demise. And the reason for that is that on the plus side of it, the Treaty of Detroit provided a pattern that offered workers regular wage and benefit increases and decent pensions, job security, those kinds of things that we sort of, when you know, Democratic Party politicians talk about, you know, unions is the key to a middle class lifestyle, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about that aspect of the Treaty of Detroit. What unions exchanged for that is they essentially granted management full control over the workplace and agreed to essentially police their membership. So they agreed to sort of keep a lid on strikes and surrender control of the workplace to management in exchange for regular wage and benefit increases and job security. So the increased wages and benefits and job security really was, you know, what built this, or, you know, what did a lot to reduce inequality, to build a prosperous working class, what's referred to as a middle class in the U.S. And that's really what came undone starting in the 70s and 80s. And the reason it came undone in the 70s and 80s and continues to be unraveling today also ties back to the Treaty of Detroit, because it undermined unions' ability to exercise their power, which is based in the workplace. So the by sort of essentially redeploying from the shop floor, unions became more bureaucratic organizations, became more and less mobilizing, less able to mobilize their members. And so when management started pushing back and saying, we maybe want to roll back some of these gains, unions were far less able to defend themselves.
The man who negotiated this treaty, who's your article refers to, is UAW leader Walter Reuther, and you say that he had progressive ideals and he helped push through some important laws, but he also did some things that many looking back today would find questionable, particularly in terms of how he waged and he centralized his power within the union. So do you think that it's fair, in light of the history that you just explained to us, to say, this is extrapolating a little bit, that Reutherism led directly to UAW organizing on campuses? And either way, when and why did the UAW begin organizing on campus?
Yeah, so before I get to the story about organizing academic workers, I think, you know, Reuther is really a key figure in understanding the U.S. labor movement and U.S. labor and political history for the middle part of the 20th century. In many ways, he was a true visionary and had real progressive ideals. One of the things I forgot to mention when I was talking about the Treaty of Detroit is that as progressive as that was considered for the time, it was actually a retreat from what Reuther's original plan was. Reuther actually, in the aftermath of World War II, was trying to advance a much broader vision of essentially industrial democracy, whereby unions weren't just sort of negotiating wages and benefits for their members, but were taking a much more active role in shaping industry. So he was saying, you know, why shouldn't workers have a say in what kinds of cars these companies build, what they build, where they build them, these kind of very fundamental management decisions. And the Treaty of Detroit sort of took that whole alternate vision of how we organize industry off the table. But the important thing to remember there is that he was this kind of visionary. You know, as with a lot of visionaries that we run into in U.S. history, he also had, you know, a strong belief that what he was doing was the right thing, and a hostility to people who tried to think that he might not be doing the right thing. Prior to his ascent to the top of the UAW, the UAW had an incredibly vibrant and contentious internal culture that I talk about in the article, with many different factions sort of, you know, with sometimes fairly rancorous debate about, you know, what the best way forward for the union is. And basically in 1947, when Reuther is able to consolidate his power, he basically forms what's called the Administration Caucus, which is sort of his leadership team, if you will, that that becomes the sort of one party in the UAW's single party state, is sort of the way to think about it. And he basically is able to sideline the various factional opponents and assert essentially this one party rule that basically continues in the UAW to this day. So that's sort of the dark side of Reutherism in a nutshell. And what you need to think about in terms of the grad students is this sort of how Reutherism plays both into the decision to organize in grad students as well as the problems that grad students run into when they start interacting with the UAW. So the decision to, so the UAW actually does not start organizing grad students. What ends up happening is initially there's this other union called District 65, which originates out of New York and is originally a communist-led union in the 1930s, organizing a wide array of groups in retail, warehouse, and such that until that point had not really played a big role in labor unions and were sort of a bit outsider, if you will. And so they had this sort of militant tradition of organizing sort of unorthodox groups of workers and having this very sort of militant approach, an inclusive approach. And so when academic workers, particularly at the University of California, start looking around, you know, in the 1970s, this District 65 looks like a good option. But the problem is that District 65 runs into some financial problems, and this is also around the same time that the UAW in the late 1970s, is running into some problems of its own in terms of declining membership, declining revenues and such. So they basically engineer a merger in the late 1970s. And so you get this merger of District 65 and UAW, which brings academic workers into the UAW. And what I point out in the article is that, in one sense, although by that time the UAW had become incredibly bureaucratized, there was this legacy of Reuther's more progressive vision about what the labor movement could be and who could belong in the labor movement. And I think that that's part of that sort of legacy, at least, is why District 65, part of why District 65 wanted to ally itself with the UAW. And that legacy, you know, creates at least a glimmer of hope for, you know, expanding the idea of what the labor movement can be and who can belong in the labor movement. And I believe that should include and is increasingly including academic workers.
What proportion of the UAW is academic workers now? And what do you think would be like the threshold? Or do you even think that's a concern?
I wouldn't think about it in terms of what thresholds are. I mean, the fact is that it is one of the, it's a growing part of the union, and you know, it's now somewhere around 8-9% of the membership, thanks in part to membership loss in the actual auto industry, but also because the UAW has been one of the most aggressive unions in reaching out to academic workers. So, you know, the fact is, regardless of what we think about it, is that academic workers are now a major major part of the UAW, whether we like it or not.
And academic workers, you point to a few issues where they take on the American spectrum what would be more progressive positions than Solidarity House, which is the name of the UAW headquarters in Detroit. So why, in your opinion, does Solidarity House oppose these positions? Is it because they think that supporting a political candidate who was as progressive as some of these academic workers would make them unelectable? Or are the other members of the rank and file more conservative? What's driving the tensions?
I think the tension has to do with a bureaucratic conservatism within the union. I'm not talking about political conservatism. Politically, the UAW is committed to a fairly standard liberal program. But organizationally, they are conservative in that they don't want to endorse or engage in activities that could jeopardize the organization itself. And so, you've had academic worker locals like my former local 2865 at the University of California, the Graduate Student Organizing Committee at NYU, and others taking stands on things like endorsing the Black Lives Matter movement or endorsing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions of BDS movement against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And these are issues that the UAW leadership, considers controversial, divisive, potentially dangerous to, the UAW in nullifying the University of California's vote in favor of BDS, talked about how it could hurt members of its own in manufacturing because it represents workers at some businesses that would be targeted by BDS. And so I think there's an organizational timidity or conservatism that's preventing it. And that's coupled with a deep commitment at the UAW leadership level to labor management partnership, which is a legacy of sort of a perverted legacy of Rutherism, essentially, because Ruther initially was, in this industrial democracy vision that I was talking about earlier, that required a certain amount of partnership. And basically, as the union weakened, it sort of clung to this partnership as a survival strategy rather than taking on management. And so their worry with these more controversial policy positions that these academic worker locals have taken is that it might jeopardize that kind of partnership that they are so committed to.
And going back to the just the workplace issue, do academic workers face similar issues to auto workers in terms of drudgery or lack of say on the job?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't want to pretend that the working conditions of academic workers are anything like, working on an assembly line. But that's not really the point of, the point is that each workplace has its own set of challenges, has its own set of problems that workers can only address collectively. And in that, workers, whether you're in an auto plant or on a college campus, do need the same set of tools. Now, that's going to be used in different ways. It's going to require different tactics, but it requires the same toolkit, if you will, and the same type of organization, which is what makes it possible for these groups to exist in the same union. So I think that, there's not much point in trying to create too much equivalence, but rather the challenge is to broaden the conception of who a worker is, what constitutes work, who belongs in the labor movement. I think that's really the more productive discussion to have.
All right, Dr. Barry Eidlin, thank you so much for joining us again today. And where can people follow your work and keep up with you?
So I'm on Twitter at Eidlin, E-I-D-L-I-N. You can also check out my website at barryeidlin.org.
All right, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, Jake.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Josie Records and KKFI present a Crossroads Music Fest showcase at the Tank Room on July 8th at 8 p.m. This Josie Records-sponsored KKFI benefit to highlight the musicians playing the Crossroads Music Fest will feature Irreplaceable Ska Orchestra, American Slim,
Sitting Next to Martin, Wasting Time,
Golden Grove, and Brody Buster's one-man band.
I say, hey, yeah, get out of my life.
This 2016 Crossroads Music Fest showcase at the Tank Room, July 8th at 8 p.m., is a $5 donation to KKFI. $20 advance tickets go on sale on July 8th, but we'll have them for $15 at this and all of the CMF showcases. Learn more at cmfkc.com or kkfi.org/events. Josie Records and KKFI present a Crossroads Music Fest showcase at Llewellyn's Pub in Overland Park, Kansas, July 15th at 8 p.m. This Josie Records-sponsored KKFI benefit to highlight the musicians playing the Crossroads Music Fest in September will feature the Thunderclaps,
You Gotta Hold On Me, Baby,
and Ragged Airs.
My train is coming, coming, coming down the road. This boy is bound for you.
This Crossroads Music Fest showcase at Llewellyn's Pub in Overland Park, Kansas, July 15th from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. is a free show brought to you by Josie Records. $20 advance tickets go on sale on July 8th, but we will have them for $15 at this and all other CMF showcases. Learn more at cmfkc.com or kkfi.org/events.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, three BNSF rail workers killed in head-on collision as safety protection is delayed. From scienceblog.com/thepumphandle for July 5th. On June 28th, three railroad workers were killed in Texas when two BNSF locomotives crashed head-on into each other. One other worker was hospitalized. According to the Wall Street Journal, the railroad has said that a new safety technology known as positive train control was slated for installation later this year along the area of track where the crash occurred, something intended to prevent these types of accidents. PTC, in which GPS and other electronic technology detects trains about to collide and automatically stops them, would have prevented the collision. The U.S. Congress has been calling for PTC since the deadly 2008 Metrolink crash in Los Angeles and initially set a deadline of 2015 for installation on key railroad tracks. According to a Washington Post account, BNSF apparently has made substantial progress in installing PTC on its tracks. Nonetheless, BNSF is said to be a key lobbyist in successfully pushing back deadlines for requiring PTC. Reuters reported in 2015 that under pressure from companies, including BNSF Railway, which has spent more money lobbying Congress this year than any other railroad, U.S. legislators passed and President Obama signed a law that delays the positive train control mandate for at least 3 years to 2018, with the possibility of an additional two-year delay to 2020. The delayed deadlines come too late for grieving families. A former Parkville woman was among the three BNSF Railroad employees killed. An obituary for Laura Gail Taylor, 45, appeared on the July 3rd Kansas City Star. According to the obituary, Taylor was born in North Kansas City and was a 1988 graduate of Park Hill High School. She was a loving mother and avid athlete. In May 2016, a federal jury in Seattle awarded $1.6 million to a former BNSF employee who was fired when he performed safety tests of air brakes on tank cars, many of which were placarded hazardous, even though his supervisors objected. The employee and his family lost their house and had to borrow money during the 6 years before the whistleblower case was heard. BNSF is one of the largest freight railroads in the U.S. It is wholly owned by Berkshire Hathaway, controlled by Warren Buffett. Finally, U.S. fines retaliation against school janitor from the Detroit Free Press at freep.com for June 30th and www.osha.gov. What's new for June 29th? The Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration awarded a school janitor more than $193,000 in damages and lost wages after finding she was retaliated against for complaining about being exposed to asbestos in Dearborn Heights, Michigan school district. Teresa Eli told the Free Press she was assigned to help re-wax floors at Annapolis High School in the summer of 2012. She said the district was behind schedule and told custodians to dry sand the floor tiles to save time rather than using water and scrubbers. They only learned after the fact that the tiles contained asbestos and say they never received training on proper removal techniques. Asbestos was declared a hazardous pollutant by the Environmental Protection Agency in 1971. It can cause lung damage and cancer, although symptoms may not become apparent for decades. Eli complained to the federal OSHA whistleblower program that she was the victim of retaliation after complaining to Michigan OSHA about asbestos in the school and elsewhere in the district. In response, Eli endured layoffs and lack of pay raises, many of which violated her union contract. Federal OSHA found the school district violated the whistleblower provisions of EPA's Clean Air Act and ordered the district to pay her $8,100 in lost wages and $185,000 for emotional distress, future medical bills, and the loss of her reputation and humiliation stemming from the district deliberately labeling her a troublemaker in district-wide emails. The agency also found a report issued by the district in 2013 saying there was no asbestos exposure following the dry sanding was false. The district has 30 days to appeal the findings. Employers are prohibited from retaliating against employees who raise various protected concerns or provide protected information to the employer or government. Employees who believe that they have been retaliated against for engaging in protective conduct may file a complaint with the Secretary of Labor for an investigation by OSHA's Whistleblower Protection Program. More information is available online at www.whistleblowers.gov. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
And now it is Molly Madden with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Take it away, Molly.
Oh, this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for July 7, 2016. Moral Political Leadership Training, led by the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber. That's Wednesday, July 13th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Swope Park, Parkway United Christian Church at 6140 Swope Parkway. That's 64130. To reserve a spot, call 816-361-1861. People's March for Public Education and Social Justice, that's going on tomorrow, July 8th to the 10th, and that's in Washington, D.C. The True Cost, Who Pays the Cost of Our Clothing, a documentary. July 26, 7 p.m., the Plaza Library Large Conference Room, sponsored by Cross Border Network. Midwest School for Women Workers, July 24th to the 28th, Roosevelt University in Chicago. Contact Stephanie Seawall for info and scholarships. On the computer, go to steeph@gmail.com. Fourth Annual UAW Regional 5 Gary Jones Charity Golf Tournament, Saturday, August 20th, 11:30 for registration, 1 o'clock shotgun start, Sunflower Hills Golf Course, 141 North 122nd Street, Bonner Springs, Kansas. For more info, call 913-342-7330. And to check out the Heartland Labor Forum, go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. or call us if you're interested in volunteering at 816-235-1470.
Thanks so much, Molly. And that is it for the show. Tune in to the Heartland Labor Forum next week, and our show will be Do Harley's Dreams of Personal Freedom Include Its Workers? And I've been your engineer tonight and your host. I'm Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.